In the last 24 hours, 1,725 deaths were recorded from coronavirus. That raises the UK total to 101,887. But it was the 1,631 deaths recorded yesterday that took Britain over the grim 100,000 milestone. It was a day where the nations came together to remember all of those people who have been tragically lost. It was also a day where Boris Johnson stood in front of the nation and said he'd done everything he could to limit the loss of life. Now, people who've been watching this show for the last 9 months will know that that's so false, so misleading as to be basically incredibly offensive. We're going to go through why that's so on this show today. I'm joined by Aaron Bastani. Aaron, how are you doing?
I'm very good, Michael.
We're also going to go through the big announcements from today, both fairly significant. So one, Boris Johnson has confirmed that schools will not be reopening after February half term. He will try and get them open from the 8th of March, but nothing is guaranteed. He has also announced a sort of tightening of travel restrictions, though not as tight as we might like. I'll be speaking later in the show to Will Davies about homeschooling, or more than that, the effect of school closures on kids. And we are going to talk also about some practical difficulties that COVID skeptics have caused in a hospital in the last week. Let's start with our first story. So as I've said, yesterday was the awful milestone of 100,000 deaths being recorded in the UK. That's according to the government's official statistics. We actually knew a while ago that we had reached that boundary, but it was yesterday that the official people who've died within 28 days of a positive test, when that reached that milestone. This is what Boris Johnson said on the day.
On this day, I should just really repeat that I am deeply sorry for every life that has been lost. And of course, as Prime Minister, I take full responsibility for everything that the government has done. What I can tell you is that we truly did everything we could and continue to do everything that we can to minimize loss of life and to minimize suffering in what has been a very, very difficult stage and a very, very difficult crisis for our country. And we will continue to do that, just as every government that is affected by this crisis around the world is continuing to do the same.
You did everything you could. You did everything you could to limit the loss of life over the past 9 months in Britain. To that, I say, really? Because Britain now has the highest death rate of any large country in the world. Per capita, we have a higher death toll than any other country, and with a population of over 20 million. Are we seriously supposed to believe that was just bad luck? That was just because people in Britain were too fat or too old, as Priti Patel would like to tell us, or Therese Coffey? It doesn't stack up. Are we seriously supposed to believe that? By the start of this pandemic, when the world watched as COVID caused havoc in Wuhan and then Italy, you missed 5 COBRA meetings. Was that really doing everything you could? After boasting of shaking hands on a COVID ward and with the rest of Europe locking down, you delayed shutting Britain's economy for at least 2 weeks. According to an Imperial study in June, that decision alone doubled Britain's death toll from the first wave. Was that you doing everything you could? In early March, you made some terrible decisions, but you could say you were getting bad advice. We do know that Sage gave some advice at the start of this pandemic, which it doesn't stand the test of time, let's say, given all we know now. But that excuse doesn't cut it anymore, and it hasn't cut it for months. So from May, those excuses fell away. In that month, you trashed the advice of your scientists and the rules of your government by defending Dominic Cummings' 270-mile trip to Durham. In fact, you said that by breaking your rules, he followed the instincts of any father. Was that you behaving in a way where you were doing anything you could to make sure that the public health advice in your government was kept? I don't think so. Then in August, when we should have been suppressing the virus and building a functioning test and trace system, your mate Rishi paid people to eat out in unsafe restaurants. As September approached, when you should have been focusing on keeping cases low while we opened schools, your ministers bullied people back into their offices, even if they were able to work from home. Was this really the actions of someone who was doing everything they could to limit the loss of life? It doesn't look like it to me. Now let's get to the winter, and this is important because it's from the 7th of November that half of this 100,000 people who have tragically passed away lost their lives. Our November lockdown was, of course, late. You ignored advice again from Sage, that time on a circuit breaker. And then in December, and this is what I find most baffling, most frustrating, and actually which I don't think you get enough flack for, is that when that lockdown was working, cases were falling, you decided to lift restrictions before Christmas so people could go Christmas shopping. And let's look at the result of that. That November lockdown with schools open, something you purport to care so much about, was working. Cases were falling. How did you justify loosening them? Cases go up, they rocket up, right up to one in 50 people having COVID-19 by the start of January. That goes up from 500,000 when lockdown ended to 1.2 million at the start of January. Is that really the actions of someone who thinks they're limiting loss of life? Did you really do everything you could have done there? I think everything you could have done would probably have meant keeping those restrictions in place. Finally, and this is the most recent, this is probably the decision that's caused the most deaths because of the exponential way in which coronavirus spreads. Once COVID was running out of control late last month, you yet again ignored advice you received from Sage on the 22nd of December about the need for a third lockdown. In fact, you waited a full 13 days to make it happen, in which time daily cases doubled from 30,000 to 60,000 per day. Do you really think that counts as doing everything you can to save lives? Aaron, I want to bring you in. This is dishonest, it's shameless. What did you make of Boris Johnson's comments yesterday?
I was kind of stunned. But I think one of the things we're going to have to talk about is somebody like Boris Johnson doesn't feel shame. And one of the key components of politics in a liberal democratic society is that people like the Prime Minister need to feel shame. And so we have an issue as a society about how do we cope with people like this. We'll talk about it more in a minute, but I feel like the Tories aren't actually trying to govern. They're still campaigning. They're already thinking about how do we deal with this crisis in a year or two's time? How will people remember COVID-19? They want to remember it, hopefully, like Dunkirk. And you think, well, how? People can only remember this as a crisis, as a failure. They won't remember it as anything but. I wouldn't be so sure. You know, British history is littered with failures and tragedies and mistakes, which we all remember as success stories. Churchill, after Dunkirk in 1940, told junior ministers it was the greatest defeat Britain had suffered for centuries. 2017 film by Christopher Nolan kind of disagrees. And so I think the Tories already, like I said, because they're focused still on campaigning rather than governing, are looking at how this will be commemorated and remembered rather than how we're processing it in the here and now. Because memory is something very distinct from experience. And you see this as well with how they refer to Keir Starmer. So whatever Keir Starmer does, and by the way, I think he is playing politics, but not for the reasons they say, they will say he's playing politics because that's what the focus groups are saying. So rather than actually engage with the opposition and try to address the situation after 100,000 people have died, after thousands, hundreds of thousands of kids can't go to school, people are at breaking point, and we're only in January, rather than engage with that constructively, the Tories' response is set by what the focus groups say and whether or not they can get a polling lead. So we have big problems here for two reasons. The people leading us don't feel shame, and they're not particularly interested in effective government. Now, normally that's a problem. It's been a problem for a long time. But when you're losing more than 1,500 people every single day for what looks like weeks, this isn't slowing down right now, that I think is unprecedented in this country's history.
I want to go through what the experts had to say about what Boris Johnson said yesterday or who holds blame for Britain's shocking death toll, for its unusually bad death toll. This was Neil Ferguson. He spoke to, he's obviously the Imperial College modeller, former Sage member. He only left Sage not because of any problems with his scientific advice, but for personal reasons. When he broke the lockdown, he told Radio 4 yesterday, "Had we acted both earlier and with greater stringency back in September when we first saw case numbers going up and had a policy of keeping case numbers at a reasonably low level, then I think a lot of the deaths that we've seen, not all by any means, but a lot of the deaths that we've seen in the last 4 or 5 months could have been avoided. And again, that was the same when it came to the first lockdown. Then the government waited 2 weeks, and that's why cases got so high before we locked down. It's only once you lock down that they start to fall. That's what we've seen, which means that the later you lock down, the more deaths you have. Back in March, Boris Johnson could at least argue that he had faulty advice. That doesn't work anymore. And that's what Neil Ferguson is basically intimating. It's in this second wave that those political mistakes were made, that this is now the responsibility purely of government. This is all on Boris Johnson's shoulders. And in terms of the importance of the second wave, I want to get up this graphic from the BBC, which is showing you sort of quite how rapidly the number of deaths have risen, which also shows you, I mean, how significantly recent decisions made by Boris Johnson were. So it wasn't until the 11th of November that 50,000 deaths were reported. Then it wasn't until the 3rd of January that 75,000 deaths were reported. So we've had 25,000 deaths in the space of 3 weeks. That's a quarter of the entire death toll over the past 3 weeks. And most of that death toll will be because of mixing that happened in a period where Boris Johnson was still ignoring scientific advice and telling people that it was fine in most parts of the country to mix over Christmas. Some of those people might have been affected in the same period when Gavin Williamson was threatening to sue schools for closing earlier than he wanted them to before the Christmas holidays. It's also worth noting that Britain is exceptional. Now, if we exclude all of the very small countries, the UK now has the highest death rate of any country in the world. So this is from Johns Hopkins University. You can see that the United Kingdom at the very top, with 148 people having died per 100,000 of the population. You can see we're worse than Italy, who got hit much earlier than us. They didn't have the time to prepare that we did. We're higher than the United States, which have been led by Donald Trump, someone who wants to inject bleach to cure coronavirus for the past year. And those are the countries, you know, we're only a little bit higher than those. Now you go back down to a country which has dealt with this well, like Germany. We've had twice as many deaths, at least twice as many deaths as Germany, per our population from COVID-19. And Boris Johnson wants to say he's done everything he possibly could. Obviously, countries like Japan, Korea aren't on that particular chart. They've done even better than Germany has. Of course, Britain's supine press will, though, do everything in its power to let Boris Johnson get away with it. These were the front pages this morning on a day when we passed that tragic milestone of 100,000 people dying from coronavirus. This is the front page of the Mail. They show "I am deeply sorry" with a picture of Boris Johnson. The Express goes for "I'm deeply sorry for every life lost" with another picture of Boris Johnson looking sad. The Sun, PM's sorrow at 100,000 deaths. And then The Telegraph, "I'm deeply sorry for every life lost." Now, there's a couple of things you can say about this. So one, should they really have led with, you know, a picture of Boris Johnson looking sad? That's what everyone's going to see on the newsstands. Could they have gone with images of the people who've passed away, perhaps? The other is that, for me, that wasn't the significant thing that Boris Johnson said in that press conference, because there was something else he said in that press conference, which we've led with today. You know, "I've done everything I could," which actually undermines that message that's on the front of those newspapers. Obviously, his press people, his PR people said, "This milestone has been hit. You've got to go out there and you've got to say sorry. You've got to take personal responsibility." But in the questions and answers section, that's when you often really find out what a politician means. Boris Johnson said, "Oh, I've done everything in my power." Now, if you think you've done everything in your power, are you really sorry? Because when I'm sorry, it's because I feel like I've done something wrong. I haven't done something as well as I think I could have done. But Boris Johnson is saying, one, I'm sorry, but also, I did everything I could. It doesn't add up to me. Finally, let's have a look at Laura Koonsberg, because obviously it is the BBC whose reporting is most influential in this country. She's gone for 100,000 COVID deaths, a grim milestone in an abnormal year. No, it's fine. I mean, she's narrating what is a meaningful moment for the country. I'm not expecting her to say Boris Johnson should resign. But abnormal year is a slightly odd way of putting it, because Britain has also had an abnormal response. She doesn't mention in that piece, that sort of analysis piece, that Britain's death toll is abnormally high, nor that our policy response was unusual, especially in the lateness in which we went into lockdowns. Aaron, I want to bring you in on this, because this, you know, obviously raises the political question, which a lot of people have been discussing, which is that, you know, Boris Johnson thinks he can ride this one out. People will give him the benefit of the doubt. It was a weird year. He's tried his hardest, even though the evidence suggests quite the opposite. It in a way feels grotesque to be talking about the, how this is going to affect people in the polls. But, you know, accountability is also an important principle in politics. And do you think there's any hope for that after this?
None at all. And I think you were spot on, Michael, in saying, how can you be sorry for something if you think you've given it your best shot? You've got nothing to apologize for if you've done nothing wrong. That's what sorry means. It means I could have done something better. I made mistakes. I apologize. So I think you're right, Michael. He can't meaningfully be sorry and at the same time say he wouldn't really change anything in the response. Clearly, any rational person would say, at the very least, he should have gone to the COBRA meetings and so on and so forth. And then I think it is really important to dwell on this, Michael. The fact that in this country, after 100,000 people have died, the person on the front page isn't any of them. Well, actually, the Times did this, but no other paper did this. Isn't the
there were a couple of others, I think.
But of the centre-right-wing press, I may be mistaken, but the ones you've just shown, for instance, obviously didn't do that. Those are the stories that count, and instead we're given the face of Boris Johnson. Now, I wonder, you know, at what point do we actually say this is a national tragedy which has affected the lives of hundreds of thousands of families, right? Is it at 200,000, at 500,000? 100,000 people is a remarkably high number. It's twice the number of people that died in the Blitz. You know, it's a huge, huge number. And I think the fact it's been processed in such a way by the media, it's almost like it hasn't really happened. You know, it's kind of like this weird distanciation between the mediation of it through the papers and through the press and actually the lived experience of the people going through this. And I think it does pose really serious questions about whether or not we're a democracy. You know, Amartya Sen has this hypothesis, I've talked about it before on the show, you don't get famines in a democratic state because people can remove the government. And I do wonder, you know, this response by the Tories and the maliciousness, I think, there's no other word for it, the complete lack of contrition by Boris Johnson last night, meaningful contrition, I think that is happening in a broader context where they don't think they can be removed from power because of how media ownership works in this country. And that's a very, very, very serious problem. And I think anybody that cares about democracy has to really say this can't carry on. And you're right. You know, I think that the front page that really annoyed me the most was the Sun, which said, we will remember them. And of course, that's trying to channel a national rhetoric around people who sacrificed their lives in war. We will remember them. This was not a war. These people didn't die to defend or to save anything. These people died, for the most part, for no particular reason. They died because, yes, there was a virus, and that's not caused by the government. But I would say at least half of these casualties, actually, you know, we talked about 25% just in the last 3 weeks. The vast majority of that was eminently avoidable. Boris Johnson was talking about 6 days off over Christmas. And that's when these things happened. And I remember, Michael, very clearly, mid-December, you said to me, we did a show, and you were talking about the new variant. And I remember talking about it to various people, and I said, there is no way we're going to have Christmas. It's going to be cancelled for everybody. There's no way schools will open in January. Zero chance. What do we get? Well, you get zone four for some places. Most of the country does have Christmas, albeit for one day rather than the six. And schools, yeah, they're not open today, but kids go back for a single day. I mean, so what, they all congregate together, they all, you know, disperse this virus, which they've all got over the Christmas holidays, and then they go back home again. You know, and this has led to the deaths of many, many people. It just has. And so the idea, we will remember them, commemoration. This is just like, you know, the First World War, the armistice, November 11th, Second World War. No, it's not. 35 people died in Vietnam. That was the best possible way of addressing this. Now, could we have done that? No, because we didn't have to go through SARS in 2003. We didn't have that memory. As a country, right? In terms of dealing with a pandemic, fine. Then let's look at Germany. Larger population has had half the number of deaths. And people say, well, is Merkel to blame? 50,000 have died in Germany. Well, for somebody who's died, if you say to them, you would have had a 50% chance that every two people have died, one of them don't die. That's a really big difference. It's a really big difference. So yes, on the one hand, there have been failures across Europe, across North America, but let's be real. We could be looking at least half as many casualties as we have. I think at least, right? And that's a serious, serious failure of government.
You know, it's a personal failure of Boris Johnson, because I think the reason he hasn't learned from his mistakes is because he doesn't seem to be a particularly compassionate person. He likes to be liked, but he doesn't really seem to care about other people suffering. But it is also a failure, I think, of our media and whole swathes of our establishment. And that's because there was a moment in this summer where people were demanding that we have some sort of mini public inquiry, immediate mini public inquiry in the summer. Now, obviously not the whole formal process. There was a lot of government to be getting on with, but just so we could learn from the mistakes that we made back in March and make sure they don't happen again. What the government, what Boris Johnson said at that period of time was, look, now is not the time for looking at the mistakes we've made. We'll do that in a couple of years' time. We'll do that when the dust is settled. And because that didn't happen, what's happened? Exactly the same mistakes were made again. Exactly the same mistakes that were made in March have been made in October, not having a circuit breaker, then made in December, not cancelling Christmas, then made in January when you had people going back to school, when everyone was screaming that this is not possible, when we were at a period where we had 60,000 infections a day. And if we had, you know, if we'd seriously sat down and taken seriously government failures last summer, then I think probably many, many lives could have been saved. There was a really tragic interview actually on Newsnight last night with someone who was from a group of people who have bereaved family members from COVID-19 who had been demanding that sort of mini inquiry, immediate inquiry last summer, who was saying, you know, how tragic it is, you know, at least when her, I mean, at least she was saying, you know, when her family member passed away, you could see that, you know, in a way this did seem like an act of God. But now all of the people she's seeing who are losing loved ones, that's completely, it's not human error, it's malice. You know, it's a complete failure to have compassion of our government and a failure of our media and our establishment to hold, you know, one narcissistic individual, Boris Johnson, to account. And that has left us where we are today in an incredibly grim situation, which is only going to get worse. And there's a Sage member again on Newsnight last night saying we might have 40,000 more deaths. That's very plausible if we're going from the baseline of 100,000, because we think actually there's probably already been 120,000 deaths, according to the ONS statistics, which get updated much later. Let's go on now to some new announcements. This is all sort of reflecting on the long durée of government policy. Now, there's been a running critique of the UK government that they've been too slow to restrict travel, allowing infections to be imported to and exported from the country. Up until very recently, the government suggested that wasn't a problem as cases were high everywhere anyway. That was something also repeated by government scientists. But the emergence of new strains of coronavirus has changed the calculus on this. Government scientists are increasingly concerned new vaccine-resistant strains of COVID-19 could enter the country, undermining our route out of the pandemic. To that end, Boris Johnson made a much anticipated announcement about hotel quarantining in the House of Commons today.
We've also banned all travel from 22 countries where there is a risk of known variants, including South Africa, Portugal, and South American nations. And in order to reduce the risk posed by UK nationals and residents returning home from these countries, I can announce that we will require all such arrivals who cannot be refused entry to isolate in government-provided accommodation, such as hotels, for 10 days without exception. They will be met at the airport and transported directly into quarantine. The Department for Health and Social Care is working to establish these facilities as quickly as possible.
So it had been long touted that the existence of new strains would mean that the government would increase restrictions on incoming travel, taking inspiration from Australia, where they don't just tell people to quarantine after arriving, they make them pay to stay in a hotel for 10 days. So there is no way that people can break that quarantine, as we know that most people coming into Britain and most British people going elsewhere, I'm sure, do. People fill in the form, they say, oh yes, of course, I'll stay in my house for 10 days, and then they break the rules. Potentially, they've had a PCR test already. They think, why am I doing this? Seems completely pointless. So that's why, you know, toughening up those measures is very necessary. The speculation at the beginning of the week was that this could apply to all incoming travelers. That would really be learning from Australia and New Zealand. That's what they did there. And it's been very, very effective in keeping COVID cases down. And it would be incredibly effective in terms of keeping new strains out. What has happened after what seems like a bit of a showdown in cabinet between Matt Hancock and Priti Patel on one side, Grant Shapps on the other, is that Boris Johnson has sided with Shapps and said, actually, let's make this a lot looser. And quarantining in hotels will only be mandatory from those countries where we have already identified new either more virulent or more transmissible strains. So we say, oh, we know that there are more virulent strains in Brazil, so we'll stop people coming from Brazil. And we know that about South Africa, so we'll stop people coming from Southern Africa. The problem with this, obviously, is that not many countries do genomic sequencing, so they're not going to recognize a new strain when it comes about. And also, it takes a long time, you know, to work out that a new strain is becoming dominant in a particular place. And if it is particularly transmissible, you don't need that many cases to come into the country for it to spiral out of control. And if we do have one which is vaccine resistant, yes, potentially we can, you know, engineer a new vaccine that can defeat it. Most people seem quite confident that would be possible, in fact, but that will take a matter of weeks, if not months. So this does seem like a government playing with fire. And Aaron, it also looks to me like another half measure, which was probably due to pressure from an industry lobby group. That seems to be why, you know, most of the government's policies throughout this pandemic have been basically half-baked.
All policies should be about solving problems, whether it's climate change, demographic aging, educating the workforce, housing, etc., obviously. But in a pandemic, you know, that's absolutely number one priority. It can't be about what's the best value for money, you know, what's the return on investment, what do various interest groups think. You can't behave like that. And as we're finding out, that's not just about saving lives, which of course it does that too, but it's not in the rational long-term economic interest of the very sectors you're listening to. You know, we're hearing now from pubs that they want to reopen. They're being told they won't be able to reopen at the soonest, which is crazy, by the way, in May. And they're saying, oh no, that's unacceptable. We want to reopen before then. But look, if this year's a write-off like last year, it's not in their interest to open in May. If it means this thing carries on for an extra year, right? Or if it means there's a mutation, which we don't need to go into this, but if it creates a set of circumstances which somehow made a vaccine ineffective or less effective, that's not in their interest either. So you're absolutely right, Michael. That's been the default of policymaking with the Tories, is too frequently listening to sort of minor interest groups. Of course, they're allowed to say what they like. That's how it works in democracy. But in a national health crisis, you know, if there was a terrorist attack, if there was somebody set off a nuclear bomb in central London, you wouldn't have the British, you know, the Confederation of British Industry or this or that interest representation group saying, well, we think we should do this. People would be, oh, God, the government's in charge, right? This isn't that different. This is not that different. 100,000 people have died. You know what? I wouldn't be surprised if we lose another 100,000. You said the 40,000 figure. Who knows? Who knows at this point? Did anybody think we would get a mutation in July or August that would do what it's done since? No. So you're absolutely right. This has been the default with the Tories. And again, it exposes a kind of problem which is really constitutive of neoliberal government, which is you never really try to solve a problem. Right, it's always about what's the best value for money, what's the cheapest. Anybody who's familiar with sort of public policy or welfare economics who's watching this, they'll probably be aware of something called Pareto optimality, which is where you only spend a pound if it means you get more than a pound back. And when it comes to dealing with a problem of this scale, it means you don't solve anything. It means you're pathologically incapable of fixing problems and making solutions. And we see that here. Always a false economy, still relying on the outsourcing, still talking about cost effectiveness and trying to save money, and still listening to specific interest groups. The government should just come out and say, we're going to govern in the public interest. Obviously, they always should do that. But in the context of COVID, we're going to govern in the public interest, screw the aviation industry and what they think, screw tourism, screw everybody. Right now, our priority is getting that death toll as low as possible, as quickly as possible, and returning to normality. Sure. But that won't happen by listening to one particular business group.
I was reading recently about how Australia managed to do so well in their pandemic response. One of the key things it said is that they ignored the business lobby, you know, because Australia, they also had a business lobby that was saying, oh, no, you can't stop travel because then that will damage the airline industry or the hotel industry. And they said, look, you know, we don't care. You know, maybe they're giving them some financial support, as they probably should in most of these cases. But there's you can't run your public health policy in a pandemic where, you know, you are only as strong as your weakest link if you let any interest group come in and say, oh, no, we need this exception for us. Because the moment you have an exception, you have a hole in your defenses, something that the Australians and the New Zealands and the Vietnamese have learnt, and we are yet to. I've said what was announced there was a downgrade from what we had initially sort of been led to believe could be the case, that this could apply to people from all countries. But the government, again, in their way, they've got a problem. Ah, what about the other countries? We know that people are going to ask us about this now that we've only said these red zones are going to have these controls. So they've had to solve this PR problem, I think, basically with coming up with some new stricter measures to apply to everywhere else. So Boris Johnson, when he's asked about what about all the other countries, likes to point out that people already need a PCR test to enter the country and are told to isolate wherever they are staying. Priti Patel today also announced new measures to stop people going on holidays.
The rules are clear. People should be staying at home unless they have a valid reason to leave. Going on holiday is not a valid reason. So we will introduce a new requirement so that people wishing to travel must first make a declaration as to why they need to travel. This reason for travel will be checked by carriers prior to departure. And this approach, Madam Deputy Speaker, effectively mirrors the checks on arrivals that are already in place with the passenger locator form. Secondly, working with policing partners, we will increase police presence at ports and at airports, fining those in breach of the stay-at-home regulations. Anyone who does not have a valid reason for travel will be directed to return home or they will face a fine. Third, we will urgently review the list of travel exemptions made to make sure that only the most important and with exceptional reasons are included.
This is classic. The government set rules which are too loose, and then they sort of announce that there's going to be a load of police to enforce them, as if the problem is people breaking the rules, not the fact that the rules were way too loose. So at the moment, sort of we have this impression that, oh no, traveling is banned at the moment because we're in tier four. It turns out, we're actually all now in lockdown. It turns out that it's only banned for purely for leisure. So if you say, I need to work for whatever reason, you can travel. That's within the rules. So she is there, as has become, you know, completely habitual in this pandemic. We have rules which are way too loose. And then you just say, oh no, but don't worry because we're going to have loads of cops to enforce them. I mean, cops will presumably then go on and harass some people who weren't doing anything other than going for a walk because they need something to do. Aaron, we're going to talk later in the show about a particular example of people who've taken unnecessary travel, which is British influencers. Hold your thoughts on that one. But in terms of this idea in general, I suppose, what do you think has gone on in terms of this particular power dynamic? Matt Hancock as well is an interesting character in this pandemic, because whilst he has made a bunch of mistakes, while he's incredibly unconvincing in interviews, he does seem to have been generally on the right side of internal arguments within government. He seems to understand that actually you do have to take tough action now to get the economy moving in the future. He wanted all arrivals to have to quarantine in hotels, and it was, you know, other parts of government, the transport secretary in this particular case, who lobby against them. The same happened with education. It was Matt Hancock who was pushing for schools to be closed when Sage wanted them to. Gavin Williamson pushes to have them open. Boris Johnson nearly always sides with the people who want a looser policy because he doesn't like to disappoint people. You know, why do you think it is that Boris Johnson has always fallen on that, oh, let's do the looser version side?
Well, I think you're right to say that it serves a political purpose to set rules that kind of broadly look equivalent to what's necessary, but then just giving enough leeway that when they fail, you can blame the public. I think there's something to that. But I also think when you're looking at the sort of the composition of the cabinet, something I've been thinking about increasingly, actually, is that we're looking at quite a specific set of circumstances with the Conservatives, because, of course, they've been in power for 10 years. But they've been in power under three different prime ministers. Now, that doesn't happen very often. And so what you've seen is effectively a series of revolutions within the Conservative Party, where various politicians, you might not agree with them, you might not like them, but they were effective, intelligent politicians, have been repeatedly sidelined. Many have now left the Conservative Party. Many are simply just on the back benches. Now, what that means is that you basically don't have particularly good people left, capable, willing to serve in the cabinet. And that is quite a new thing. The sort of turnover of the churn of Tory cabinet ministers, particularly since 2016, I suppose, is unprecedented. And so, you know, the level of personnel, whether it's Hancock, whether it's Priti Patel, I agree with you. In this instance, Hancock seems like he's talking more sense. I think that's why the caliber of the people at the top is so low. And that's not Boris Johnson's fault. That's not any particular person's fault. If you're being sort of political scientist about this, it's just the context, which was inevitable when you have three prime ministers in 4 years. Various factions are fighting with one another. Various people are sidelined. But it doesn't make for effective government. It really doesn't make for effective government. You add that to the ruling Tory ideology. You add that to the capture by certain interests with regards to making policy. It's a shit show, which is why we've had 100,000 people die, which is why we've had 25,000 people die since the beginning of January.
Mm, absolutely. Now, since a weekend briefing that schools might not open until Easter, Boris Johnson has been under pressure, especially from his backbenches, to set out his plans for a return to in-person learning. Earlier today, he made this announcement in Parliament.
It will not be possible to reopen schools immediately after the February half term. And I know how frustrating that will be for pupils and teachers who want nothing more than to get back to the classroom, and for parents and for carers who spent so many months juggling their day jobs, not only with homeschooling, but with meeting the myriad other demands of their children from breakfast until bedtime. And I know too the worries we all share about the mental health of our young people during this prolonged period of being stuck at home. So our plan for leaving the lockdown will set out our approach towards reopening schools. If we achieve our target of vaccinating everyone in the four most vulnerable groups with their first dose by the 15th of February, and every passing day sees more progress towards that goal, then those groups that have developed immunity from the virus about 3 weeks later, that is by the 8th of March, we hope it will therefore be safe to begin the reopening of schools from Monday, the 8th of March.
Obviously, that phrase, begin reopening the schools from Monday, the 8th of March, is very ambiguous, probably as it should be. To reopen all schools on the 8th of March would be incredibly dangerous. Boris Johnson, they're saying the reason they can consider reopening schools is because the first four priority groups will then have been vaccinated and their antibodies will have kicked in. But that only goes to people who are 70 and over and people who work in healthcare. And the majority of people who go into hospital are under 70. So you're going to have a real, real problem if there is a sort of push, as the Tory backbenchers want, to just reopen everything after half term. That wouldn't be a good idea. There's going to be, obviously, you know, a lot of pressure from the NEU, quite rightly, to make sure that they aren't open before they are safe. But we will see a lot of haranguing from Boris Johnson's backbenchers to say, throw caution to the wind. Let's get everything open. Now, on the question of school closures, on Monday, we spoke to Chloe Tomlinson for a teacher's perspective on what it all means, what it's like to teach remotely. But what about parents? Will Davies is a political economist at Goldsmiths, author of many books, most recently This Is Not Normal, The Collapse of Liberal Britain, and is also a longtime friend of Novara Media. Now, I didn't get Will on to talk about his most recent book. I'll probably get James Butler to do that. I got Will on because you've been tweeting a fair amount about your experiences of having your five-year-old and your eight-year-old learning from home during the COVID lockdowns. How has that been for you? What conclusions have you come to?
I mean, it's been a mixture of kind of fruitless, maddening, and you know, occasional kind of glimmers of fun, and you know, there are occasional upsides to it, but it's a very tough experience. Obviously, I'm concerned for my kids, but I'm also very aware that it's not the kids of people like me. With, you know, I'm privileged in terms of having a secure income as a university academic and providing them with a kind of an environment where they're probably going to be okay one way or the other in the long run. But I have seen a lot of news reports over the last, getting on for a year now, from various places such as the Sutton Trust and the Children's Commissioner and elsewhere, about the kids who are far less fortunate than mine. And so I guess some of my tweets are a mixture of kind of personal exasperation with the situation, but which I wouldn't claim to become a sort of standard against which to judge the broader political situation, with a genuine sense of concern for what is happening in terms of social justice.
And also, I mean, what I've sort of inferred from your tweets, and I've often, you know, shared this view at times during this pandemic, is that there's some people on the left and some people on Twitter, especially, I wouldn't necessarily say the NEU, who I think have been fairly responsible, have been quite cavalier about schools closing. So almost celebrate that they're closed and say, you know, education on the internet can be just as good as education in schools. The only problem is laptops. If we had laptops at home, then there would be no problem whatsoever. And we could have just closed them until, you know, 100% of the population was vaccinated with no problem. Well, is that correct? Yeah. I feel like
we all know, you and probably most of your viewers are aware of some of the kind of arguments that have gone on since March. And Keir Starmer obviously decided to kind of nail his colours to a school reopening mask back in May and he put out these statements about, you know, I expect schools to be open by this date. And, you know, he was at odds with the NEU, which is obviously a sort of a risky position for a Labour leader to take. But, you know, and that had its own sort of political dynamics with it. I think as a parent, probably I think something which a parental perspective that I would see as having some kind of political weight or some kind of giving me some kind of insight to the situation is that when you witness those arguments going on, you do wonder exactly who is actually standing up for children in amongst all of that and who actually speaks for them. Because the long-term consequences for these closures is obviously, I'm not suggesting that the closures haven't been necessary at various times. And I'm not suggesting they're not necessary now. I'm not a kind of Toby Young style libertarian on any of this sort of thing. I totally understand that we need to kind of listen to what Sage and the epidemiologists and the modelers are saying. That's taken as a given. But I think it's difficult to watch school closure becoming a kind of a sort of rallying cry. And there were backbench Labour MPs who were sort of tweeting, close the schools. It was a sort of hashtag over Christmas. And yeah, the schools closed. So it might be that this was simply a sort of a demand purely based on the evidence and so on. But I think that there are multiple other things that just at least need to be kept in mind here. And one is that, of course, there are huge inequalities. Look at the Sutton Trust research on this in terms of who is actually, not just technology, because it's very easy to talk about, you know, free broadband and laptops and so on. But first of all, who is actually getting education in the home? Some kids are getting basically none. And that is going to have, potentially it has very long-term consequences for them. Private school kids, where the technology is sound, the supportive environments are sound and so on, are steaming ahead throughout all of this. That's there in the Sutton Trust research. And it's worth remembering that different schools generally have to go about as fast as their least privileged kids to some extent, because when the kids all come back into school, there's all the catching up that has to be done. And if a child has done no reading and has actually gone backwards for several months, that becomes where basically a lot of the class is positioned. And that's obviously a good principle of an egalitarian state education. But it's also worth remembering kind of where some of the other schools might be by the time that those schools come back. The thing which I think bothers me quite a lot, and this is a lot to do with the curriculum reforms that have come in under since Michael Gove was Education Secretary, is the way in which online learning meshes with a certain kind of pedagogical philosophy, which actually strips much of the humanity out of learning and teaching. So I think that the left should not be on the side of anything that just sort of kind of accelerates the digitization of education, both for humanistic reasons of the nature of what education should be, but also if you read the work of people like Ben Williamson, who's a critical education scholar at Edinburgh and was quoted in The Observer over the weekend, there was a sort of stealth privatization going on as a result of this pandemic, where some of these Californian platform-based edutech companies are getting themselves into schools. Parents have heard of these things called Class Dojo and these sorts of things, and obviously Google Classroom is everywhere. And some of this stuff won't, some of these genies won't be simply put back in the box. The same thing's happening in universities, my own sector. So I think, you know, some critical awareness of this sort of stuff needs to happen. Yes, close the schools, but don't neglect the fact that there are many parties here who are suffering, who have not actually got a voice of their own, and B, notice who is actually gaining from all of this, because it actually, you know, there are some winners who are making off with profits and lifelong advantages in the labor market and elsewhere.
And I don't want to put you on the spot now. I know you're not an epidemiologist. And I know that, I mean, in a way, it's no one is the official representative of parents or children, are they? But from a personal perspective, someone who's a political economist, sociologist, when do you want kids to go back into schools? How do you see that process happening in a responsible way, which takes the rights of kids into account, and the safety of everyone?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, I realize it's extremely complicated and very difficult. And the question of workplace safety is not one that can be sort of easily traded off against these other goods. And that is the ultimate difficulty of all of this sort of stuff. And we're going through this with universities as well. I think that a switch towards recognizing that ventilation and outdoor space is actually just as important as matters of, you know, hands washing and all this sort of stuff, I think would be helpful. I've seen journalists, and Susan Mickey on Sage has written about whether or not certain kinds of outdoor space would be ways of getting kids back into some kind of social contact with other children. You know, they desperately miss their friends, and that whether or not that has sort of serious kind of emotional harms and developmental harms, and it's something that a child psychologist would need to comment on, not me, but they do desperately miss their friends, obviously. I think teenagers are particularly sort of troubled by that, because for teenagers, their friends and their school is in some ways their sort of life, you know, to some extent. I mean, like, it's different. I mean, mine are young enough that actually they kind of quite like hanging out with their parents, even if they don't always say it. But I think that teenagers, that I think this is extremely important that they get the possibility of certain forms of social exchange. I mean, Susan Mickey pointed out, and others have pointed out, that what happened in Denmark was the government had started trying to requisition additional spaces, tried to find additional staff so that you could teach in smaller groups. It doesn't have to be, you know, 9 till 3:15 every single day, Monday to Friday. What it means is that trying to keep them in touch with the very conditions of their social and public world, you know, in a way that I think we just about sort of reproduce it as adults via Zoom and this sort of thing. But I think that the idea of reproducing social existence online for children is really sad, apart from anything else. But I don't think it doesn't work. And I think for teenagers, I think it's a huge deprivation. I mean, of course, lots of people are being deprived right now. I'm not suggesting that these needs sort of somehow kind of trump everything else. But I think that since March, Gavin Williamson is an utter disgrace. I think that he's got no interest in education. He's got no interest in schools. He's got no relationship with teachers. He's put himself at odds with the teachers and the teachers' union. That is obviously the worst way to start trying to solve what is a fiendishly difficult problem. But I think that, you know, I do think that the left should be on the side of trying to support the socialization and the humanistic teaching of children, because it's an absolute fundamental part of a social contract, which extends well into the future.
Will Davies, thank you so much for joining us this evening and for your insights on homeschooling. Great to have you on Navarra to talk about something other than the books you've just written.
We'll talk about neoliberalism next time.
Yeah, thanks, absolutely. Michael. Let's go to our next story. We've heard from the many doctors we've had on this show that the army of COVID deniers on social media are an enormous source of frustration and cause an unneeded dent to morale. However, in an East Surrey hospital this month, COVID skeptics created a more practical challenge.
If you want to have a quick conversation, I can just quickly debrief you and tell you what the current issue is and what the problem is here. Since being moved from AMU, none of the family have been consulted with what's his medical condition. Yesterday he went off the radar. The hospital have been lying to all the family.
What are you doing with him?
My main concern is his safety. No, and at the moment, you are making him unsafe.
No, right,
he's taking his oxygen off. He's going to die if we don't put it back on.
No, I'm not.
Yes, you are.
No, I'm not.
Can I just say something?
It is against the law. You put yourself all at risk. Okay? We need to step outside. If you go home, you will die. He has coronavirus pneumonia affecting both of his lungs. He's on steroids called dexamethasone. He's on antibiotics to treat concurrent bacterial infection. Okay?
Right.
That's the treatment he's on.
And that's it?
To my knowledge, if we get his drug chart, I can tell you what he's on.
Right, okay. I emailed him to the hospital about saying that the family wasn't happy with the steroids and the antibiotics and they'd be able to replace it with vitamin C, vitamin D and zinc. Plus, there was another one, I forget what the lawyer told me earlier. But
none of those are proven treatments for coronavirus. However, antibiotics and steroids are.
The person they're trying to take the patient off oxygen against the wishes of his doctor was Toby Hayden Lee. He describes himself as the patient's Mackenzie friend, which is an untrained legal observer. Patients have the right to them. It's quite it's a fine system, obviously going quite wrong there. You heard them there saying, you know, ignoring all of the wishes of the doctors, saying, no, he can come off oxygen, it's completely fine, then disputing all of the different functioning medicines he was being given and demanding that a bunch of basically vitamin supplements, be replaced with those effective treatments. At the moment, you might think, oh, what's going on? Is this just some people who've read some stuff about the correct treatment for coronavirus and want to have their voice heard in a particularly obnoxious and quite chaotic fashion? No, the next part of the clip shows us the true motivations of the people involved.
So you're putting this whole ward up with bowls and
green. You are.
What,
you
me personally?
Are. Yeah.
Why is that? Why am I personally?
Listen, can I just say something, please? I am his next of kin.
Right. Now, sorry, Doctor. Doctor, now, if he's going to leave, now, obviously, they've got oxygen indoors.
He'll last about half an hour before he goes.
What? Oxygen?
I'm not giving him oxygen to go home with.
No, what I'm saying is, what I'm saying to you is we've got oxygen at home.
Not this much.
Coronavirus, or you say corona? Can you define coronavirus?
SARS-CoV-2.
Yeah, that hasn't been proven to exist. But it was declassified as highly it was declassified on March 19th, 2020. It's no longer highly contagious infectious disease.
SARS-CoV-2 hasn't been proven to exist. I feel for everyone involved. I feel for everyone on that ward. I feel for that guy who's been taken off his oxygen. I mean, it seems that he was, you know, in on this as well, but he's been taken off his oxygen. The doctor's pretty confident that if he leaves that, he's going to die. He says he's got oxygen at home. Those don't normally last for more than 5 or 6 hours if you're, you know, requiring the kind of pressure that you have in a hospital. So this is not going to work out well for the guy if the visitor gets his way. But you also just have to, you know, the doctor there, you know, imagine you're going into work every day. You're seeing, you know, you're seeing so many people die. It's one of the most traumatic experiences of your life, probably the most traumatic experience of your life. We know how many doctors are getting PTSD, and you've got someone who is coming in trying to take one of your patients off oxygen and telling you that SARS-CoV-2 doesn't exist. How do you define it? It was shown that it's taken off the dangerous infections list. This isn't even a thing. We just want to get him home and feed him some vitamin D. We'll talk about the political surroundings that have allowed events like this to happen in one moment. First of all, let's take a look at what happens next. The security are called to have the pair removed from the hospital.
Sam, what
I'm
your
not going to continue having this conversation.
I need to understand what your plans are.
You're going to be
are.
Removed by the security guard now.
Okay? So, get off, mate. Get you now.
Or what? Listen, or just what? Get off him, please.
Listen, that's a legal paper. That's my son.
I need that paper.
This is legal paperwork. I'll walk out of here.
Then you
let me give the paperwork to her.
You can.
Let go. Let go. Get go! I'm trying to.
With me, he's coming with me.
Paul was contacting me.
What do you mean no? Did you just say no?
No visitors in the hospital.
Sorry?
There's no visitors in the hospital.
Yes, we're not visitors, we're coming here to pick Paul up.
You can't go home.
Says who?
Me and his doctor.
But you've got no power of attorney over him. You can't decide what he can. If he wants to leave, he can leave. You can't stop him.
You can't take him home when he's going
to
die.
If he wants to leave, if he wants to go and die at home, that's up to him.
If he wants to go and die at home, that's up to him. I mean, there are actually some circumstances where that probably is a reasonable argument when someone is in hospital. And normally in that situation, the doctors are incredibly responsible. And they say, if that's what you want to do, if you are now in a palliative, you know, state, if we know that your life is going to end soon and we just want to make this as comfortable for you as possible at home, that's something doctors are very used to doing. What doctors aren't used to doing is have someone storm in with no mask on, going through, you know, wards where there's patients at real, real risk. And dragging someone away. You know, how chaotic that must be if you're working in that hospital. But also, how did we end up here, where we're in the middle of a pandemic? Yeah, obviously, in this country, actually, there's much lower vaccine skepticism than we initially had feared. But you still do have this very noisy minority who are not only on social media saying, oh, it's all due to false positives, COVID-19 is just like the flu. And now you've got some examples of them storming into hospitals and dragging patients out.
Yeah, I think it's really important to say, Michael, actually, from the start, that in Britain, this is less of a problem than elsewhere. You know, you're looking at places like France, where basically 50% of the population aren't really sure they want to take a vaccine. I think, and also what's interesting in the last few weeks is actually things are moving in the right direction for Britain. So already within Europe, we were one of the least COVID skeptic nations, and it's getting better. For all the criticisms you might want to make of the BBC, I think principally that's because we have a public service broadcaster with this huge market share, huge, 80% of radio, TV, huge online footprint, and that squeezed out the COVID-denying right-wing press. That's one thing. Secondly, again, I'm just trying to sort of, I'm playing devil's advocate here. You know, it's highly probable this stuff happened in 1919 with the flu. It's highly probable that a significant part of the population during a collective trauma, which is what this is, process it in such a way that they deny it is happening and they behave like this. You know, I'm sure there were similar sort of maniacal scenes during war, during famine, I'm sure. That's not to excuse it, but I think, you know, we have to sort of put it in with historic context. Thirdly, I think the government, in its initial response to COVID, provided fertile ground for these people, sadly. Fourthly, you've got social media. So I think social media comes actually quite, you know, quite low down in terms of people generating these conspiracy theories. What I find more worrying, and actually this goes further back, is how the COVID denialism and these people come out of movements like, you know, Freemen of the Land, supremely anti-rationalist arguments, right? They won't be sort of swayed by empirical data. And that can actually be traced back to, I think, quite mainstream positions. So, for instance, the MMRA jab, you know, in the European Union, for instance, we don't have genetically modified crops because they're Frankenstein crops. There's no rational argument for not having genetically modified crops. It's because there was basically a scare surrounding them in the late 1990s generated by activists. And I think that we have to make the argument for science, for rationality. And I think actually in the last 20 years, that's not been a thing. And then finally, I think the reason why people are doing this, and this was an argument I first heard in 2016, 2017, about why many, many people voted for Brexit precisely because they didn't think it would change anything. They didn't think leaving the European Union would actually have severe consequences, so they didn't really care. Because, quite frankly, since 1945, we've lived in a period of unprecedented political stability and progress. Rising living standards, rising home ownership, elimination of various diseases and hunger, and we're all eating more kilocalories. Life expectancy is going up. Now, I think since 2010, that's clearly plateaued, but there have been no major wars, no major famines, no major pandemics. And so I think to an extent, this denial as an actual sociological theory, because like I say, I think people have always denied traumas when they're in the middle of it, but this kind of movement of COVID skepticism, I think reflects that. These people have never seen a tragedy like this before. I find it hard to believe that if somebody had lived through Stalingrad or somebody had lived through Dunkirk or 1919, the pandemic then, I struggle to believe they would exhibit the kind of political features that we're seeing with the COVID skepticism. I think it's an outgrowth almost of unprecedented abundance and stability and not much happening. And again, that's why they're processing this in a strange way. Now, that's not to excuse what they're doing. That man is an idiot. You know, I think he should be locked up. And I say that as somebody who thinks the prison population should be significantly reduced. But I do think it's deep-seated. And I do think to an extent it's explicable. If you look at the long durée of politics, really since 1945, combine that with a move against rationalism, really, in the last 20 years. You then add on poor communication from the government and then, of course, social media. And this makes sense.
We do spend a lot of time sort of critiquing the BBC for not being, not even sufficiently critical of the government, but for basically covering for the government by making everything seem like a natural disaster instead of potentially any fault of Boris Johnson. But when it comes to keeping people living in the same universe, which is to some degree evidence-based, they're quite good at that. So if you look at the United States, you have a much higher level of COVID skepticism than you have here. And that's because they don't have a public service broadcaster and half of the population are watching something owned by Rupert Murdoch, which is precisely actually why we should be quite worried about GB News coming in this country and trying to compete with the BBC. I mean, I don't think they will be able to sufficiently or severely compete with them, but you could imagine them getting sort of 10 to 20% of the population who are sort of addicted to watching that Andrew Neil show. And we know that Andrew Neil, chair of The Spectator, that has been the main outlet for COVID skepticism in this country. So you have to think, if the same people who currently work at Talk Radio, you know, not many people listen to it. It's very much a sort of Minority Endeavor. They get a lot of attention because they say outrageous things on Twitter, but you know, a lot less people listen to talk radio than they do LBC or to the BBC radio channels. But if you have lots of the people who are on talk radio, who are, you know, Julie Hartley Brewer apparently is being looked upon as someone who might go on GB News with a big show. She has been someone who's been pushing all year this false positive story, whereby it's just a pandemic which looks like it's really bad because of the number of false positives, and really there was never a second spike. You know, now they change their stories every now and again. Now it's that, oh, actually, yeah, of course there was a big spike, but people would have died anyway. Ah, yes, of course there was a big spike, but the lockdowns caused more damage. They change their story as each of their last stories becomes shown to be completely false. And you can see how these attacks on public service broadcasting from billionaires, from Rupert Murdoch, from GB News could be really dangerous here. It's also worth saying it's not only, you know, proper COVID skepticism that is a massive minority in this country. It's also actually, you know, lockdown skepticism, which, you know, is a much more respectable seeming position, the kind of thing that Julie Hartley Brewer believes. I don't think she'd be dragging anyone out of a hospital, but she does think that lockdowns do more harm than good. That doesn't have any scientific backing. And actually the public on issues like that are more informed than Boris Johnson, it seems, because the public consistently have backed going into lockdowns and taking serious early action against COVID-19 when Boris Johnson has avoided having to make that decision. If we'd put the public in charge of the COVID response, we might not have had 100,000 people die. The next story actually has something to do with the wellness industry, which we don't talk about very much. This weekend, the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, made it clear that international travel should not be happening and made specific references to those travelling for leisure.
International travel right now should not be happening unless it's absolutely necessary. You know, no parties in Paris or weekends in Dubai. That is not on. And in most cases, it's against the law. And so international travel should not be happening unless it is absolutely necessary, for instance, for a medical emergency.
Now, one person who Hancock may have had in mind is Sheridan Mordew. She's a fitness influencer on Instagram who decided to travel from her residence in a tier 4 area to Dubai for what she calls an essential work trip. She appeared on This Morning. Here she is explaining why she made that journey.
The main reason was for my own self. Mental health kind of thing. So obviously during the second lockdown, I was really struggling. Being a motivator myself, obviously a lot of my clients depend on me to bring their motivation, to bring their happiness and all that. So as the third lockdown was coming in, obviously because I'm a business, because I'm a PT, I'm self-employed, I took the opportunity to think, right, well, my mental health suffering, what can I do? I need to motivate other people. I'm not going to start something new by just sitting in the house. And I had this idea and I could not be bothered. Like, I shouldn't really be saying it because obviously a lot of my clients look up to me being, you know, Mrs. Motivator, but with my own self struggles, I thought the only way I'm going to get out of this is to find the opportunity to get on a plane for essential travel and get out to Dubai.
The phrase I really liked there was, I couldn't be bothered. I couldn't be bothered. So she went to Dubai. She's saying, and absolutely, I don't want to make light on anyone who has found the lockdowns in this country incredibly different. I know. For a fact that the lockdowns we've had have been a huge weight on people's mental health. But I think most right-thinking people would think that probably in the middle of a global pandemic, you can deal with that issue without flying out to Dubai. Obviously, in this instance, this person has said, oh no, this isn't against the rules. One, I want to, I can't be bothered not to. Two, it's allowed because it's essential work. She's saying, look, I'm an influencer. My job is to inspire people, to motivate people. I can't do that if I'm not inspired and happy. So therefore, I had to fly out to Dubai. Again, it's not clear she's broken the rules. This is another situation where the government's rules were way too lax, were much more lax than they needed to be. In this last clip, let's go to this. She gives her other defense that her work is essential because it's motivating people.
So my job is to motivate people. Do you know what I mean? If I was going to be lazy, if I was going to sit back, if I couldn't be bothered to provide a service, sometimes it's a free service. At the minute, I'm providing free workouts on my Instagram. I could just sit back and just think, do you know what? I'll wait until the gym's open. But because I've got such a high demand of young girls that I want to do it.
This image doesn't motivate me. It makes me feel utterly jealous. Like, I'm just so jealous. I just want to feel the sun on my skin. That's all I want. I would love nothing more than to do that.
That was essential. What you posted there was essential.
That, yeah, there's loads of videos on my Instagram. Obviously, that was just the one me riding a camel. But do you know what I mean? I think if you ever had a look, obviously had a look at my Instagram, you'd see workouts. But I think in a world where you can be anything, be kind. And I think a lot of people forget about that. And my job is to help people get fit and be motivational, whether it's in the house or it's in Dubai.
But can I just say something? When you say be kind, like when we see how stretched the NHS is and those nurses that are working really, really hard, and all they are saying is, please stay home, do the right thing, stay home. And you're saying, be kind. Are you being kind to them by encouraging others to travel for what you deem as essential work?
Yeah, I mean, it's not necessarily that I'm trying to influence anyone to come out. It's just the fact that I'm doing my kind of thing. I mean, if anything, I'm getting people motivated in the house. I'm not saying, come on, let's get out, let's go outside. Like if I was in England, I could do classes outside.
Aaron, are you motivated? You're in lockdown, obviously. Does it make you feel, you know, warmer? Does it help you get through this difficult time to see people riding camels in Dubai?
I mean, isn't it crazy, Michael? Imagine if we started broad. Imagine if we all flew out, the Navarra media team flew out to Dubai or to Abu Dhabi or to Java or whatever, or Vietnam or Thailand. And we said, oh, they wouldn't have us, by the way. We'd be effectively a biological weapon. And we said, we are broadcasting Tisky Sal Monday, Wednesday, Friday, live from the Al Burj in Dubai for your mental health. I mean, have you ever heard a big load of bullshit in your life? I mean, it's just preposterous. I mean, it was ridiculous. What makes me laugh the most, though, is the fact that Philip Schofield was laughing at, you know, Boris Johnson. You didn't really see him there because he's laughing at her too. But he was taking an influencer who went, you know, on the back of a camel in a desert. He was taking her to task more than Boris Johnson last March. If only he had this journalistic rigor 10 months ago, maybe we wouldn't be in such a desperate situation. But yeah, her argument was utterly ludicrous. I mean, she's the whole thing about if you could be anything, be kind. I mean, Jesus Christ. This kind of nonsense is what I think the West, big W, is in deep trouble. We have idiots like this broadly shaping the culture. And that's why, you know, this is the Asian century, Michael.
It's now become an all-purpose iconic excuse, hasn't it? Be kind. You know, if you're late for work, come on. Be kind. If you broke it, that's actually what Dominic Cummings should have said. Maybe if he'd come out with that instead of I was testing my eyesight, people would have, you know, taken it better. Sorry, I drove to Durham, but, you know, be kind. It's worth saying she went in January, so it's only now that Hancock has been firm about international travel. And again, that's, I suppose, an important reminder to say, you know, we don't really want to be joining in the pylon against this particular person. Yeah, it seems like she's made a bit of a dumb decision and her explanation for it is terrible. But at the same time, the government basically has been saying, you know, do what you want, travel is fine. And we've consistently heard this sort of real blending, this real sort of diluting of what the concept of essential means. Essential work, only leave the house for essential work, but you've got people working, you know, in estate agents in the office that could be doing that at home. Only do essential things. You know, all shops are open if it's click and collect. I mean, not all of them. You walk around, lots of them are. If they sell some sort of food, they get to call themselves essential, I think. The concept of what counts as necessary activity has sort of blurred in a really odd way, and not always in one direction. I think not always in the same direction. I mean, I think in many ways, the government has been way too strict with social activity that happens outside, especially in the first lockdown, and especially the press have in terms of the moralizing about people going for a walk with friends. They've sort of said, oh, no, that's not essential, and then been way, way, way too lax about what counts as essential when money is being exchanged. Obviously, traveling to Dubai means money is being exchanged. And as we know that the government do have the airline industries in their ear, you can see why it's only now when they're under severe pressure from the public and their scientists that now they are completely changing their tune. Whereas, you know, before Christmas, they might have said, of course, yeah, it's great to have influencers going to Dubai because it supports the airline industry. Now they're becoming objects of hate. And there's all of this moralizing about it, even though what's actually happened is a U-turn on the part of the government. Aaron, your final thoughts on this beyond it representing the decline of the West?
We've all got people we follow on Instagram. I've seen people in Dubai or whatever, and they're like drinking from a coconut or, yeah, like on a, you know, with a snake or in a, you know, what do you think? And all the comments below are like, oh, I love you, this is great, I hope you're happy. And I'm thinking, what the hell is wrong with these people? Why aren't they angry? What is going on? What's going on? Right?
They're just happy for people having fun.
No, but it reminds me of, you know, the film Elysium?
No, I don't.
Very good film. And you basically have this off-world colony of the ultra rich, and they have incredible technology, and they don't grow old, and they don't die, and they have these med bays that fix everything that's wrong with you. And then the rest of humanity lives on Earth, racked by climate change and unemployment. It's just a hellhole. And, you know, people on Earth are trying to get to Elysium because it's a parable about, I think, borders and people seeking asylum in the 21st century. But what the film gets wrong, is, if this story is anything to go by, is that people wouldn't be upset with those in Elysium. They wouldn't be angry with the elites. They'd be going, oh, my God, love you. Hope you're having a great time living to 400 and never knowing physical pain while I die at 25 from, like, you know, skin cancer because there's no ozone layer left. Love you, kiss, kiss. That's kind of what it, you know, Elysium, you got it, Matt Damon, you got it wrong. You'd have to do a remake, make Elysium 2, because the people on Earth are so stupid that rather than despise the people oppressing them, they love them. You know, they elevate them. I don't think that's human nature, by the way, but that's what those comments would have you think underneath these people's profiles. And I don't think we covered it. That same lady was saying, I employ three people, I create value. You don't create any value. The society would be absolutely fine without Instagram influencers, right? It's like with Navarra Media, the world would be a lot worse without journalists. That's why we do this, right? Good quality information, actually, we increasingly are recognizing as a fundamental to democracy. Fine. Would the world be any different without, you know, fully automated luxury communism, non-fiction book? Probably not. I mean, you need ideas to progress as a society, but it's not a public good like journalism is in terms of dissemination of accurate information. We don't need influencers, no. It's great we live in a society where they can exist, and I'm happy for you, but no, it's not necessary.
I think maybe some influencers probably do good work, you know, but it's not essential enough to go to Dubai and ride a camel in the middle of a global pandemic.
It's not socially necessary. Like, you can't compare it to care work or to cleaners or to food production or to, you know, roadside maintenance, etc. And by the way, those are the jobs that are paid the least, and they should be paid the most because we need them more than anyone else.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll end on that point, which we definitely agree on. Aaron, thank you for joining me as ever. And thank you all for watching and for your kind super chats tonight. We'll be back on Friday at 7 p.m. So make sure to hit subscribe. You've been watching Tisky Sour on Navarra Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Navarra Media. Go to navarramedia.com/support.